Bienvenidos a Un Cisne No Tan Negro, el podcast sobre inversión ángel, venture capital, startups e innovación.
Un nuevo episodio de Un Cisne No Tan Negro. Soy Daniel Salvucci, conductor de este podcast y parte del equipo de inversión de Draper Cygnus. Tenemos como invitado en este episodio a Pedro Sorrentino. Pedro es partner del fondo de venture capital OneVC, un fondo que está basado en Silicon Valley, en Estados Unidos y en Brasil, invirtiendo en toda la región y en las compañías de los mejores emprendedores en Estados Unidos. Como a ellos les gusta decir, emprendedores inevitables. Pedro tiene una historia muy interesante como emprendedor, después como uno de los primeros empleados de SendGrid y luego haciendo su camino hacia el venture capital. Este episodio va a estar en inglés porque el portuñol de Pedro y mi portuñol no eran el mejor, así que espero que se entienda mi English. Y como ya saben, esta temporada no podríamos hacerla sin el ayuda de nuestros sponsors. En primer lugar, quiero agradecer a Amazon Web Services por apoyar esta temporada del podcast. Amazon nos trae su programa AWS Activate con créditos gratis, asistencia técnica y capacitación para todas las startups y fondos de inversión de la región. También quiero agradecer a Brown Rudnick, firma legal especializada en Venture Capital y Private Equity. Sin más introducción, disfrutemos la conversación con Pedro tanto como la disfruté yo.
Hello, welcome to a new episode of Un Cisne No Tan Negro. We have Pedro Sorrentino with us. Hi, Pedro, how are you?
Hey, Danny, how are you? Pleasure to be here with you.
No, thank you. Thank you for being here. We are recording this episode in English. So my English is not the best. Your English is better, but you are the one that is interesting for the audience to hear today. So that would be great. I would like to start by knowing a little bit about your past life previously on funding OneVC. We are going to talk about your venture fund later. We're going to talk about details about that, but we like to see the audience. I want the audience to understand how someone becomes a managing partner of a venture fund. So if you can go back in your life where you have a startup past, you work for startups too, and then you enter the investment industry. So just go backwards and tell us about you and how you got here.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, pleasure to be here with you. Thanks for the invite. I apologize because, you know, la calidad de mi portuñol no es la mejor. Entonces, it's better for us to talk in English. At least, like, I think I can guarantee you that the audience, like, that speaks English, like, I'll sound better. The path towards becoming a venture investor, I don't think is really obvious. And if you look around towards everyone that kind of joined our industry, they just have all sorts of different types of background. I certainly sit on the least obvious camp to a degree because I used to be a journalist. There are a few journalists in our industry.
Famous journalists in the industry.
And yes. There are some journalists that are tremendous investors in the industry. But I would say that we are the minority, but there's a parallel there because as a journalist, you have to analyze 100% of topics with 1% of depth and quickly process information and investigate in a highly competitive environment with imperfect information. So it does correlate quite a lot with early stage investing to a degree. And I think that it correlates even more with earlier stages versus late stage investing. Which end up being way more quant and so forth. But to answer your question, before starting OneVC, I was on the investment team of another firm called FCVC. And then prior to that, I was an operator at a company called SendGrid. Was the first business hire there. Learned tremendously. You know, I should say that we went through 3 to 4 cycles of hard things about hard things. Scaled the company from a 0 to 100 million revenue. And then I went public and then the company was acquired by Twilio for about $3 billion. And prior to that, I was, you know, what you'd consider, I consider myself a failed founder. I've had 2 startups. I sold the first one, but didn't make any money. Learned a lot, though. I was very young. I was 21. And the second one was an events company that did matchmaking between VCs and founders. And it was more of a cash type of business, not necessarily a venture-backed type of endeavor. But the summary of my path towards this is that I've been working in tech since ever. I kind of gave up journalism in the middle of college because I was just frustrated with the overall biases that you'd have within the industry. Something that now actually is something that's very true with all these problems of the media that we're seeing more and more. But I already found that that was already something that annoyed me back then. So I kind of gave up on it. Plus the economical output of a journalism career is significantly less interesting than, you know, if you get to be a successful investor.
Absolutely. I think investing in being a VC has taught a great part of knowing a lot of people, getting on their stories and getting to know how they see the world, which is very much correlated with the work with a journalist. But we got to share the upside. I think that's more important.
Absolutely. I think it's you do these like systematic investigations into the human condition. Yeah. You know, like yesterday I had a call, you know, we're going to call this company that we're looking at, and we spent over an hour just talking about how they met and how they aligned the way that they aligned before we even started into the business, because these things do matter a lot for the long term.
Yeah, your experience is, I think it's great for now, because you have that experience to try to start a company that it turns out it wasn't perfect fit for venture, as a venture-backed company. And we see a lot in Latin America and in US, a lot of companies trying to build something that not always fits the venture capital model. I like about 1BC, your venture fund, that claim of investing in inevitable founders. Why don't you tell me a little more about that and 1BC?
Yeah, happy to. I mean, we came up with that because we realized that life is much, it's a self-serving thing. Basically, it's much better to invest in people that don't need your help. The ones that truly need your, it's not that we're not helpful. I believe you can call any CEO we've worked with. We're one of the most resourceful firms out there, specifically with the fact that we only have, you know, 3 full-time partners at this point. But, and so the point here is that you need to work with folks that, irrespective of your involvement, they will get there. Yeah. That sounds counterintuitive, but it's so important. And I know there's, you know, that the founders of Rappi or the founders of Pipefy and the founders of Rocket Chat and all these other firms, all those companies that we have invested, like they would be successful even if we weren't there. And that's what makes our involvement special. What we do is that we just help them get to the destination faster. That's where we come in, to help them raise more money with the best possible people available, recruit candidates that are deemed impossible, and properly position their companies in the media, because PR kind of brings up all sorts of other avenues for the business, both internally and externally. So so it's self-serving for us, and we know, it's almost as if, you know, you start talking to someone and you kind of have that feeling that they are inevitable, and we think that that's very important.
Yeah, you know, our industry is paved with counterintuitive things. Actually, you and maybe I, we are kind of young in the industry and we have like eclectic experiences how we got there. And as you said, there's no straight path to venture capital. That's one of the things we try to get the people to know of through this podcast. And as you said, we are not here to babysit startups or entrepreneurs. We have to find the best ones. So it's counterintuitive because they are going to build great things with or without us. But at the same time, they need venture capital because they need to scale their companies fast. They have this small window of opportunity. Unpacking a little bit more about 1BC and you. You are from Brazil. Your venture fund has two sites, one sitting in Brazil, the other part sitting in Silicon Valley, in San Francisco, where you are. Why don't you tell us why a venture fund with Brazil origins can be great and successful as it is in Silicon Valley?
Yeah, absolutely. This is a natural transition into the genesis of the firm. You know, we were started by six partners that have known each other for a decade. And prior to putting the firm together, we've invested in 71 companies, and we're fortunate to have had 27 exits in 5 years. So we made almost 8 times the money cash on cash and personally anchored the first fund and then raised the rest. So originally it was going to be a small $10 million fund, and we ended up raising a $30 million fund for our first fund, which was a very fortunate situation.
Yeah, not a common one also. That's an outlier in itself.
Yes, I would say so. And then, but in addition to that, I think it gave comfort to our investors, the fact that we've had almost 5 times more personal money into the fund than your average VC.
Yeah.
So it's not even that we have skin in the game, but we also burned, you know, everything behind us and went sailing, not knowing what was going to happen. Unfortunately, you know, we have good days, bad days, but things are tracking into the right direction. So I forgot your question. I'm sorry.
No. Yeah.
Oh, about the geographies. Not, okay, I got you. Sorry, I remember. So, because of the fact that both myself and one of our venture partners, Rafael, we've been in the Bay Area for so long, and we've had co-invested already with some of the best firms out here. You know, with DST, with Sequoia, with GGV Capital, with Kleiner, with Accel, and so forth. It was normal for us to just do business the way, you know, just continue to invest in the Bay Area. That said, there were 11 unicorns that came out of Brazil in the past 5 years. We also funded 5 of them. So we felt like it was a very compelling case to build a unique financial product that isn't available in the market. No one else that I know does what we do. That's exactly why we're doing what we're doing. It's a little harder sometimes for institutional investors to fully understand what we're doing, because, you know, they want to place you in a bucket. But we don't care, not because we don't care about them. It's because we understand that it takes time for people, you know, to fully digest what's a novel type of product within our little ecosystem. And there are parallels as well. So Index Ventures, right, started in Europe, hired Mike Volpe, expanded to the Silicon Valley. Today is one of the most successful venture firms ever. A lot of folks have done that with Israel and the Bay Area. Not a lot of people were doing that with Brazil and the US, and that's our focus.
That's great. That's something in common we have at Draper Cygnus. I share the feeling on the double work we have to do to explain that we are not focused in Latin America. We are not only from Latin America. This is difficult to explain to LPs. I will get to that later, but
it depends on the type of LP. I
mean, that's
why I mentioned there are other LPs that love it. They understand it. They want more of it. It depends so much on the type of LP.
What do you think about the latest trend of now diversity is something that everyone is talking about, especially in the US? Do you think that's going to be helpful for us, for funds like us, to make an argument more easy about our diverse backgrounds being helpful on choosing good entrepreneurs?
I don't think about that much, to be honest with you. I only care about being a firm recognized by high quality financial returns and investing in incredible entrepreneurs, and that's it. Shouldn't be about where I'm from, what's my name, what's my race. When I am in touch with confirmation biases on the other side, because I have an accent in English and my name is Pedro, I don't suffer from it. I don't make myself a victim. I just hustle harder. I work harder. I try to understand the perspective of the other person. That said, diversity is a problem within the industry. And I just think that, you know, we do need a more reasoning rhetoric around the whole diversity issue, because it's tough, because how do you remove human confirmation bias on, you know, there's a difference between doing a panel on female founders versus just doing a panel on founders and inviting a woman. And that difference is so important. And it's clear that society at large has not reached like a sophistication level to be at that point. But you also have these people that are just fighting these battles on social media and Twitter, and you know, it's tough. So diversity is important. It matters. It's good for business. But if diversity is the number one thing that I talk about when I talk about my firm, then I'm not doing, you know, my job. I know you didn't mean it that way.
No, I didn't mean it that way. Yes, that's the way that maybe is mainstream. But what I'm getting from that, what I read and I talk and I discuss is, we understand that, you and I, because we come from diverse societies. And as someone placed in San Francisco, diversity is inside the business venture capital model. It's a no-brainer for me. It's always about diversity without saying diversity, because I don't care where you are from, who you are from, what do you like. If I need inevitable founders, like you say, I don't care who you are or where you're from. That's my job, to pick those winners, regardless where they are from or who they are.
Yes. And it's tough also. And we need to do a better job. You know, like we need a woman on our team, you know, and also I would say that hiring someone that's not Brazilian. But we had to get started in one way or the other. And in the level of trust that's required to start a VC firm, you know, is pretty high. So so I think we started with a very solid bedrock. And from now, you know, we're maturing and evolving. And it's something that all of us as partners care tremendously. So I think, you know, sometimes it will help. But sometimes also it doesn't help, because someone will have a non-flexible diverse mandate. And I have also encountered that. And I'm just like, okay, so like you only accept diversity if it's very specific to your agenda. So it's a much more complex topic, I would say, as we learn how to just live, you know, in a society that has more empathy and compassion and so forth.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. That's my way of seeing this thing. What I think, it will be easier for us to raise funds now that they understand that they have to be diverse, and we are. That's our origins. Changing topics. How you just said coming together with a busy firm, it's really about trust. So tell us a little bit more about you and your partners. How do you met? How do you came with the idea of together bring and make one BC?
Yeah, it's a crazy story, but kind of like we all connected the dots. Like it was almost as if it was this combination of alignment, you know, 5, 6, 7 years in the making. So I used to work for SendGrid. Bruno Yoshimura, that's another general partner at the firm, was my client at SendGrid, and we kept in touch. I became an advisor for a company that he invested as an angel, and he made that invitation to me. He knew this other, one of our other partners called Eduardo, and I knew Eduardo back when I used to organize these venture events in Sao Paulo, and he sponsored one of these events with a box of cachaça. Literally, because we needed like some alcohol for the event, and we kept in touch that way. And it turns out that Eduardo and Rafa were childhood best friends. But Rafa has been living in the Bay Area for over a decade and has been an investor here for a long time. And there aren't that many Brazilians that are high quality investors in Silicon Valley. And we connected because he just reached out to me over LinkedIn for us to grab a coffee. And I didn't know that they were childhood best friends, right? And then Alex and Arthur, the other two partners out of the six of us. Arthur, he's worked for Eduardo's companies, and we knew each other already from the startup ecosystem. It's the same for Alex. So this is literally almost like that Steve Jobs commencement of, looking back and connecting the dots, and we were all connected in one way or the other. And Bruno and I were having a conversation about starting a firm together focused only in the US, as he was going to go here and, get his MBA and maybe stay after. And the other folks wanted to do a firm that was 100% focused in Brazil. And we figured, hey, why don't we just join forces and do both? So that's what we did. There were two names, actually, and there was this one call where we literally flipped the coin to make a decision on the name.
I like one, so I don't want to know the other one. Let's keep it there. Yes. 1BC is great.
Thank you. I like the name too. It was the one that I came up with it, and I was freaking out on that call. I was just so nervous because I really wanted that name, and I'm glad that the infinite spirits just helped out on that one.
It's great. It's simple. Yeah. Just for the audience, why don't you tell me a little bit more about the investment strategy on 1BC, and then we can jump on more on other topics.
Yeah, absolutely. We're a generalist firm investing, in everything that's technology or technology enabled, except for hardware, medical devices, and biotech. For the US, we have this macro model, what we call the multiplicative model, basically, where we look at market, founders, and people in that order. Market has to be large enough to provide venture-like returns. And then, of course, it's always about the people. But if you have the right people at the wrong market from day one, it makes it a hard case to even invest, right? So we always start in the market. It's something that, we learned by studying all the other firms, and we realized that the Sequoia thinks that way, and we think that they're pretty good. So
they know what they are doing.
Yeah. Exactly. And in addition to that, there's a great blog post from Mark Andreessen where he talks about that as well. And there's so many examples of companies that have spectacular people but not so great products in the right market, and they become very large. Right? Oracle, Salesforce, these are all old, outdated products.
Slack was a bit
exactly. No, it's also an interesting one. We don't use Slack at 1VC. We prefer WhatsApp and for the low-level touch communications that we typically do. I think if we were a larger enterprise, we would use Rocket Chat. That's one of our companies, but that's a whole other story. But so generalist firm. Market, people, product. And then for LATAM specifically, there are two types of strategies that we follow. So we either want you to be doing what we would call, Latin America from hell, basically, which means highly complex. You can't have an entrant that would come here and just copy you. And the addressable market is enormous with a world-class founder or a world-class founding team that if we put you in front of Sequoia, Andreessen, Greylock, Accel, Benchmark, et cetera, you're going to deliver. That's why also the quality of the English of our founders is something that's so important. If you're not solving something for the local market, there are exceptions. And, you and I share portfolio companies, unfortunately not as co-investments. It would be nice, to be in that situation. But we share portfolio companies that started from Latin America to the world, right? In your case, you have Auth0 and Cytologic. We personally, some of the founders of the firm invested in Gympass, and then we were also investors in Pipefy and Rocket Chat. So there was Authy in Colombia, right? That was acquired by Twilio. So there are a few examples in Latin America. Those are minority. I would say that in a year and a half of meeting three new CEOs a day, we find one company maybe with that profile. So we have a lot more of the local LATAM problems with a sizable market led by spectacular teams.
Yeah, those are winning combinations, and interesting to see that those different theses regarding their geography. We are talking about startups now, so why don't you pick one or a few of those portfolio companies that you're really excited about, and tell us a little bit more about them.
All right. Well, since I'm wearing orange, we're going to talk about Rappi, and then I think that that's an interesting company that has almost unlimited upside potential, because as they continue to roll out new products within that app and becoming this remote control for your city in a super application, just the size of that company continues to grow and grow and grow. And the unfortunate situation that we're having right now with the COVID pandemic is actually working out really well for them as a business. I think Rocket Chat also is fascinating, because, you know, you were talking about Slack not necessarily being a good solution or a good product. And the clients that Rocket Chat has, you know, like you have military branches of several governments, you have like the largest like utility companies of large countries, oil and gas distributors, companies that run massive railroads, you know, infrastructures, and all these folks are going through digital transformation, but they're just not willing to pay what Slack charges, which is quite an expensive product, as well as not having the data federation flexibility that they want with their internal communication tools. So those are two interesting examples of the portfolio. They are completely different, right? Like one is a consumer app and the other one is an enterprise open source.
I can see why Slack is not working. You just go through a few industries that are not based on workforce sitting on a desktop, coding. They are utility companies, oil and gas. Those are all companies that have people on the ground, and it is not the same workflow on how do you chat and share information with your coworker. So I can see why Slack there is not the perfect solution, and why your company, your portfolio company, can do something different.
Yes. Yeah, we hope so too. So far, so good. But yes. Yep.
And why don't you, I think our work is great. I think being part of a venture firm is one of the greatest work. I want to do this for my entire life. I might think that you feel the same way. Am I right?
Yeah, definitely. I think I'll be investing until I die. I mean, it's such a privilege to just be around.
I know your answer, but the question is, why everyone that is in the industry from this side, we are all in the same page in that we want to do this for the rest of our time. Why do you think is that?
I think each person has a different answer. For instance, for my partner, Bruno, you know, he always talks about, it's not so much about giving back and helping founders. And I believe in that as well. It's not that that's not important for me, but I like the game. I like playing the venture game of like, hey, let's find the best investors, let's raise money from the best people, let's build a firm that looks incredible. And it is incredible for folks, you know, competing against opportunities, thinking intellectually and critically with good judgment about investments and so forth. So, and it's important to have this diversity also on like, why do you want to do what you do? But for me, I can't think of a better job in the world where you're always talking to people that are better and smarter and more driven than you, and you just help them in their path. While you help create a bunch of jobs. So, you know, if I think it's the best, distribution of wealth and economical value that you can possibly be a part of. But I don't see a world where I'm just doing this forever. There are also all sorts of other things that I think are important and interesting to do over the course of one's like lifetime. But I will always, my plan is to always do this and get better at it, because it's hard. Investing is not easy. And you learn. It's a very humbling, job.
Yeah, totally. Very humbling. As you said, one of the best parts is meeting those incredible founders, scientists, guys that are much more intelligence than us, but at the same time, that's humbling. But it requires, as you say, that intellectual, constant intellectual roaming. And one of the things I love is we are constantly debating on how do we want and will be the world in the future. We're always looking in the future and trying to pick those guys that are going to make the future. And talking about future, what excites you about the future? What are you seeing that you want to be part of back in a company that's going to make it possible?
Yeah. We don't do that much deep tech investing, you know, like you've mentioned, like you guys. So, but we are participating in a few interesting, developments of, I think, evolution of the human condition in the world. One of them is the democratization of healthcare by cutting all sorts of middlemen. The first exit of our fund was a company called Hey Doctor that was such a good RX, where you could get a prescription in less than 15 minutes at a pharmacy right on the corner. And one doctor could actually prescribe over 35 patients in 1 hour, because you've had these decision tree through machine learning. It was so simple to just understand, you know, what's the condition of this person and how can we help and then, you know, help them. Right. And the other one that we're seeing also is just the D2C of everything in large categories. So we've invested in a high protein ramen noodle company, and you're seeing all sorts of like innovations in food, right? Another big trend that we're a part of is basically how open source software can actually be a very smart go-to-market strategy to capture customers and then help them, you know, grow further. It's not a new thing. It's been done for more than 30 years, software, but we're still in the early days of that. And we try to think long-term for the new trends, meaning we've never been that attracted to VR, for instance. I think that a lot of folks now trying to do companies in the virtual event space because of the pandemic, or just the remote work type of companies. It's not that we don't believe that these trends are happening, but instead of remote work, for instance, I think that no code solutions is a far more interesting value proposition, because it can be applied for remote workers and non-remote workers, you know, in whatever new scenario we're going to have once COVID is over. So those are some examples that that we have been a part of. One additional example is how much we like APIs and infrastructure. So always about picks and shovels, right? There's a gold rush. We're going to sell you shovels. We're not going to sell you gold. And we have that in companies like Coldcov, IDUAL, Swap. That's a fintech as a service, banking as a service platform. So those would be the larger trends of our portfolio so far.
Totally agree on your API. I think API-based business models are not that common, but we call them like building blocks of the next part of the industry. Those companies are great. When we came across some of them, there are no-brainers. But there's a lot of school there to do in the entrepreneurial world. Not everyone is thinking that way, and I think there's a lot more opportunities on shaping business model on APIs, on something.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, I think that, like, having been the first business hire at SendGrid, I remember when Auth0 came along, because you know, we raised money from Bessemer, and that company raised money right after we did. And I actually went sailing once with the former CEO, the Microsoft guy, I forgot his name, and this very nice guy. And the identity management as a service, such as the logging services, it was a new thing. It started becoming a problem once other building blocks were already set up, you know. So you'd had Twilio and Stripe and SendGrid and New Relic and all these other things. And then now what's next? And then, you know, authentication became a big part of it. You've had better data structure, right, through Datadog and a few other companies. So you always have to be one to two steps ahead of what's happening, because it all happens at the edges, right? You're not going to read anything on TechCrunch or none of that. You have to really be out in the field talking to the people that are doing the work and knowing what are the problems that they face. And that takes time and effort, right?
Totally. And being very, very focused. So, but finding those gems is interesting. Just to sum up, I just want to give you a little bit of freedom of use this space to send any message you want to send to startups, to LPs, to Latin American, to US, whatever you want.
Well, thank you, Danny. I appreciate the opportunity of being a part of the podcast here. I think the work that you guys are doing is great. For us, if you are building, right, like a business in the Bay Area, it could be in the US at large or in Latin America, with high emphasis in Brazil, get in touch. We're all available. It's pretty easy to find our information online, and it would be a pleasure to just learn more about, you know, what you're working on. And I thank the opportunity to be a part of the program here.
Well, you can follow Pedro on Twitter. He's a very good Twitter. He's very intelligent. Yeah, I follow you. And you will be engaged. If you follow Pedro, you will see really bold and direct opinions about what's going on day by day and in the future. So follow him. It's very interesting. And well, thank you, Pedro, for joining us in the podcast. And well, hope we can find in the field co-investing.
That'd be great. Yeah, we're a pleasure to co-invest. I appreciate the time and all the best to everyone that's listening.
Thank you.
Thanks.